This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In January 2015, an ambitious goal was set to rid Mecklenburg County of chronic homelessness by the end of this year. That's just a little over 6 months from now. So, how are we doing? Reports tell us homelessness is down, and the people involved in this effort say they've had something to do with it after raising millions of dollars to put hundreds of the most vulnerable people into housing. This hour, we delve more deeply into the problem, their ambitious effort, how successful they have been, and what it will mean if their plan works. Dale Mullinex is executive director of the Urban Ministry Center. He's in our Spirit Square studio along with Stacy Lowry, director of Mecklenburg County Community Support Services. And welcome to you both. Welcome back to you.
Thank
both,
you.
I guess
Thank
I should
you.
Say. Define, before we start, define chronic homelessness.
Chronic homelessness is a particular subpopulation of the larger homeless population. People who are chronically homeless have been homeless continuously for a year, or they've been homeless three different times that add up to a year over the last 4 years, and they have some kind of disabling condition.
I was going to ask you why they find themselves in that situation.
It's because they have that disabling condition.
That condition could be what?
It could be a mental illness, physical illness, could be an addiction. Oftentimes, it's a combination of those things.
So many of these individuals, Stacy, have mental or physical problems. Others, I would guess, are simply down on their luck. People run into people live paycheck to paycheck, and when that paycheck stops, they're pretty much in trouble. But you point out that if you earn minimum wage in Charlotte, you have to work 92 hours a week to be able to afford fair market rent. I mean, that's an important thing for people to understand, I think. So how does the difficulty in finding affordable housing on a minimum wage salary affect this problem?
Well, I think that we definitely have an affordable housing issue here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. Our housing instability report specifically looked at what fair market rent was, what people would need to earn to be able to afford rent. And like you said, you have to be working at least 92 hours a week instead of 40 to be able to just afford a two-bedroom apartment with your family. Or what that means is a housing wage would be closer to $16.62 an hour to be able to afford housing. So I think that chronically homeless individuals and families, they obviously have issues as far as disabling conditions that contribute to the difficulty to earning a wage that high or to be able to have the ability to work that many hours per week.
Right. Plus, I would think even if you're not chronically homeless, I mean, if you can't find affordable housing, you might end up being homeless. And 92 hours a week is a lot of work, it seems to me, to be able to pay for housing. We've already have a scarcity of this kind of housing for low-wage workers, and more of that housing seems to go by the wayside as development continues at a rapid clip. So that must be contributing to the problem. Do you feel like you're fighting a losing battle here?
Not at all. And actually, helping to understand the different subsets of the homeless population helps understand our challenge. So, for instance, the vast majority of people who are homeless because of some situation that occurred in their life, the most common being a lost job. But it could have been a death in the family of a breadwinner, it could have been a divorce, could have been a major illness. Those are folks we refer to as situationally homeless. Most of them, and they are about 85% of the homeless population, most of them, if those of us in this business are doing our job right, they'll escape homelessness within 45 days. So it's this small segment, the chronically homeless, who are 10% to 15%. They're the ones that you kind of recognize. They kind of fit the stereotype. They are also the ones who have been homeless the longest. They're the ones who generally cannot access the traditional means out of homelessness. And they're the ones who cost our community the most money.
And the traditional means out would be what?
Well, reconnecting people to income.
Okay.
So if someone lost a job, you know, we're doing our part. Our partners who do this work are all doing their parts to try to help people get reconnected to work. And then they can begin to make their way out of their homelessness. Someone with a disabling condition is probably not going to get out of this with work because of their mental illness, for instance. And so they may have no income, at which point we then help them apply for their disability benefits for which they're due. But, for instance, the folks who live in Moore Place, our housing facility for people who were chronically homeless, the average disability income is $733 a month. Mm. You can't live anywhere in Charlotte if you make $733 a month.
Right. You just mentioned a second ago that the chronically homeless make up about 10 to 15% of the homeless population,
right,
but they consume 50% of the resources.
Right. That's correct.
Why?
Because of the services that they use over and over and over again. So, for instance, we did research with the University of North Carolina at Charlotte about the services that chronically homeless people use, and almost all of the – or the preponderance of the costs are medical. And so multiple visits to the ER, multiple admissions to the hospital. And so the average chronically homeless person in our community, we discovered, was costing our community about $39,000 per person per year. And almost all of that was medical. Mm. We house them, surround them with supportive services, change their lives, their health, and so forth, and it costs us about $14,000 per person per year.
This is like so many of the problems that we talk about on this program, where preventive action or intervention
right,
saves the money that
right,
we spend to punish people or to take care of people because we haven't done the preventive action.
Right.
Why is that a lesson that seems so hard to learn by so many people in so many sectors, not just this sector? It's a hard lesson.
Good question. I don't know. One of our colleagues talks about this is the place where ethics and economics meet.
Okay.
And it makes perfect sense. That's what it is. It's ethics and economics meeting.
You created a registry of the chronically homeless by taking a point-in-time survey, I think, in January of 2015, and I believe you did it again this year. But let's go back to 2015. How many people did you end up putting on that registry? Do you know?
Well, there are two parts to this story.
Okay.
Every year, our community does what is called a point-in-time count. It's a one-day snapshot of the homeless population.
Volunteers go out.
Volunteers.
How do they know where to go?
Well, oftentimes we get help from outreach workers, or we get help from police officers, or they go to places where they know homeless people will be congregating, like the shelters, the Urban Ministry Center, and so forth.
But not just that.
But not just that. So when we wanted to do our registry,
mm-hmm,
we wanted not only to count people, we wanted to get their names, their locations, and understand something of what they were dealing with in their lives. Mm-hmm. So we asked for help from the community, and we had almost 300 volunteers show up. And so for 3 days and three nights, rather than just the one day, we were out 5 a.m. till into the evening, going into the woods, under bridges, to the ERs, to the jail, looking for chronically homeless people, and then interviewing them using a research tool created by some doctors out of Boston called the Vulnerability Index. And it gathered information about their history, their health, their income, and so forth. And so that registry, we ended up with 516 chronically homeless people.
So if you have 300 people interviewing and looking for and interviewing,
yep,
these people, how do you know that you're not counting the same person two or three or four times?
Well, it was built into the plan, but that there is a risk. And so what we did was, as soon as we had the registry created, then we had a team of basically data scrubbers, mm-hmm, who went through there and validated all those names.
So 516 chronically
homeless
people.
If they were not chronically homeless, they were still counted as part of the annual point in time, but they did not do that full interview that we were doing.
That was in January 2015.
That's correct.
You went back in January of this year, right?
Yeah, we conduct the annual HUD point in time count every January,
okay,
across the nation.
Why
everyone
is it,
does
why
that.
Is it January? Is that because that's when the height of homelessness is, or why? They just had to pick a month?
My understanding is that would be the time that most likely people, when that the weather is inclement, they would be able to go into a shelter. So you're more likely to have a better snapshot of individuals because they would be accessing shelter, as opposed to perhaps April, May, when it's nicer outside, you may have more individuals sleeping in camps,
right,
that you wouldn't be able to count otherwise.
Okay. So you did the day and time, or the point in time, mm-hmm, survey again this year, and what did you find?
Well, we found that the overall homelessness in Charlotte-Mecklenburg decreased by 9% in the last year and 36% since 2010. I think one thing that we were very happy to see is that chronic homelessness decreased in the last year by 39%. And that is something to congratulate our community on. Like Dale said, the chronic homelessness is something that's very difficult to work with. These are individuals that have been on the streets for many years. So the fact that our community can show that what we're doing is working, that using housing as a platform for stability is something that will end homelessness, especially for chronic homelessness, I think we should be happy about.
And the decline is based on the point-in-time survey, is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's a comparison of the numbers between the years.
If I understand this correctly, although there were only 516 chronically homeless people found in your survey of 2015, there were 1,818 homeless in January of this year of all categories.
All categories.
Of homeless people. So what about the chronically homeless? Has that number gone down as well?
It has gone down dramatically, 39%.
So 39% is the chronically homeless.
It's the chronically homeless. And it's, one thing that's important to understand is the point-in-time count, as I mentioned, is a snapshot. What we're doing with this effort to end chronic homelessness, our registry is more like a motion picture because we meet new people. Mm-hmm. Some people disappear. So, I mean, it's a very dynamic number, but we scrub that data every month to get the most accurate number of who's left.
So when you point to these declining numbers of homeless people, both in the chronically homeless area and other areas, are you saying that this is all due to your efforts? Could it also be due to an improving economy, to some other factor, or all of these things going on?
I would say that it's multiple factors that are improving the conditions regarding homelessness in our community. I do think, though, that the work that we have done collaboratively, all the agencies and local government, to create by-name registries for veterans and for chronically homeless allows us to employ best practice interventions and strategies that allow us to understand our population better. But I think that's only a piece of what would be contributing to our numbers declining.
Okay. And how often have you looked at this population? I know you mentioned 2010. So when did you start surveying and trying to keep count of the number of homeless?
Well, the point in time has been going on for years.
Okay.
And that's a national activity that goes on in communities across America. The kind of expanded registry that we did one in 2010 and found 807 chronically homeless people. 2015, we did the expanded registry, found 516. So that's a reduction of about 35% in 5 years. Now we are counting every month as we're housing the chronically homeless through the Housing First Charlotte-Mecklenburg Initiative, and we're keeping up with that number monthly.
In 2015, one category of homeless had increased, and that was those living in places unfit for human habitation, including camps, cars, and under bridges. Why would those numbers have gone up, and how has it changed since then?
Well, it's difficult to say whether or not they actually went up or whether or not we did a better job of counting and finding the individuals where they stay.
Okay. That's Stacy Lowry, who's director of Mecklenburg County Community Support Services. Dave Mullinex is also with us. He's the executive director of Urban Ministry Center. He's also the director or the project manager of Housing First Charlotte-Mecklenburg, which is one of the programs that they attribute these declining numbers to. And we'll talk about how that program works and why it is different from what has been done before and what is being done in some communities around the country, which does not contribute to success, not the kind of success that we have experienced. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Ashe County, celebrating the arrival of summer with hiking, biking, kayaking, and fishing. Located in the northwest corner of North Carolina, bordering Tennessee and Virginia. Details on Ashe County at thecoolestcorner.com. And Pike's Pharmacy, featuring Meds Monthly and Pike's Pass Packs. Patients receive all regular medications monthly at one time and may be prepackaged for individual daily dosage. More info at PikesPharmacy.com. Alma Adams wins her Democratic primary race, and Robert Pittenger squeaks through on the Republican side. Ron Kimball will be the interim Charlotte city manager. Governor McCrory vetoes a coal ash bill, and we hear about the next steps the General Assembly may take as a result of that veto. More on the effort to stop the I-77 toll lanes, and more stories than that, actually, when our roundtable of reporters gathers tomorrow for the weekly news roundup on this program at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, a former Stanford student, 6 months jail sentence for raping an unconscious woman, has sparked outrage across the country. The growing number of reported sex assaults on campuses and how courts and colleges are responding.
The Ian Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dale Mullinex is with us, the Executive Director of the Urban Ministry Center, and Stacey Lowry, Director of Mecklenburg County Community Support Services. We're talking about homelessness in Charlotte and the chronically homeless people who have disabilities that put them into homeless situations for a year or more. And Charlotte's success in helping many of these people get out of that situation. What is the number right now of homeless and chronically homeless people in Charlotte today?
Well, it's a, like I said earlier, it's a dynamic. It's a dynamic number because we find new people that we didn't meet last year when we created the original registry, and we also can't find some people that we made contact with last year. We think there are still a little over 300 people out there from our best count. One of the things that has really helped us in the Charlotte Mecklenburg initiative is we have increased our number of outreach workers from 3 to 11. Mm-hmm. So we have 11 people who are doing all their work out on the streets, in the woods, in the camps, under the bridges. And so that has made a tremendous difference in us keeping up with the numbers of people that are out there.
Talk to us about who these people are. Are they Charlotte natives? Have they come here because the weather is nice? Seriously, that's a serious question. Or because they've heard that Charlotte does good things for homeless people? Who are these folks?
It's a common question and a reasonable question. In my 22 years experience, what I've discovered is the chronically homeless are incredibly non-mobile. They are from this region, this area. The people who come to Charlotte who end up homeless oftentimes are the situationally homeless. Some cousin, some friend, somebody says, come here, there are jobs in Charlotte. And they come here and things don't work out.
Right.
But typically those are not the chronically homeless people. Mm-hmm. These are folks who do not move around.
So you don't worry that as we become really good at helping people that we will become a magnet for more to arrive here. You don't worry about that.
I've never met anybody who said, I couldn't wait to get here and eat at your soup kitchen. You know, it just doesn't happen.
You're also not shaking your head vigorously over there, Stacey.
Yeah. This year, during our point in time count, we actually asked individuals how long they had been in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg community to test the hypothesis that people aren't coming here because services are good. Mm-hmm. And what we found was that the majority have been here for many years, in fact. I know when I go nationally to different conferences and stuff, I hear from other colleagues that will say, it seems like everyone from Charlotte's moving to New York. So we hear the same kind of stories that people
even among professionals who deal with them.
Yes, we do.
So why do they think people are coming to New York and we don't think people are coming to Charlotte?
I think it's a common myth that people are driven to where services may be good, but as Dale said, I've never met anyone who said I wanted to go and become homeless and relocate to a different
state. I understand
that,
but if people in the profession who deal with this every day as part of their jobs are saying, hey, people are leaving Charlotte and coming to New York, these are New York people saying this to you, why do you have a different point of view?
Why don't
you share their opinion?
I think that many people hear that. We hear, oh, people are coming from different states.
Just I know, but like, they're professionals. You're a professional. Why do we have a different point of view among professionals?
Oh, than the general public.
Yes.
I think you'd have to ask the people in New York because our experience certainly doesn't validate that.
Okay. In addition to being director of the Urban Ministry Center, Dale, you are also project manager of Housing First Charlotte Mecklenburg, which is going to be a mouthful for the rest of the
you
show.
You said that very well.
Because that's because I'm reading it. That's the group that has banded together on this goal to end chronic homelessness in Charlotte by the end of this year. Who is in this group? What organizations, what kinds of people are in this group?
There are 26 different organizations that came together in the beginning of 2015 to make this declaration. They include the banks, Carolina's Healthcare, they include the city, the county, they include Center City Partners, they include the university, the library, the police department, the Chamber of Commerce, nonprofit organizations who are already in this work. It's a wide range of our community.
And why did this wide range of people? Because a lot of these organizations don't have a lot in common. Why did they come together on this?
Well, we are grateful that really Center City Partners was a key player in bringing people to the table. Mm-hmm. There was some concern in 2014 about the number of people who were sleeping on benches uptown, and that created the conversation. What are we going to do? And there was an idea, well, what would happen if we just took the benches away? And we started looking for a bigger solution than that. And so one conversation led to another, and with each conversation, more people came to the table. And what we did was presented the data on what we have learned about how to successfully end chronic homelessness with people, mm-hmm. primarily from our work through More Place. And so as we presented that data, then the group came together and said, okay, let's do this.
The banks have gotten a bad reputation around the country because of the recession and some other things as well. But why would the banks be interested in this? Why are they interested here in this?
Well, I think they have a commitment to us having the finest community possible. I think also it was acutely obvious when you have as many people as we had sleeping on benches in the middle of uptown mm-hmm. that became a concern. But, you know, my experience is the banks have been incredibly philanthropic and supportive of homeless services for as long as we've been doing this work. So I don't think that was new. But I think probably the situation in 2014 just raised everybody's attention to a little higher level.
So there's Housing First Charlotte Mecklenburg, and there's also an Urban Ministry Center program called Housing Works. Are these the same programs, different programs? How do they differ?
We are just one player in Housing First Charlotte Mecklenburg. There are five other nonprofit homeless service agencies who are participating in this. We are using the model that we have been using for the last 9 years, but we are just one player in that whole effort.
And how is the county involved in all of this?
The county is a player as far as being a collaborative partner. We do provide homeless services also within the Community Support Services Department, and specifically our contribution to Housing First Charlotte Mecklenburg is we are paying for part of the evaluation of the actual collaboration, and we also have supportive services funding that we can pair with housing subsidy for the nonprofits.
Now, let's be clear. This, I don't know how long this has been going on, this Housing First paradigm. How long has it been going on? Let's talk about that.
It started in the 90s. As a matter of fact, a man named Sam Cimbaras, who is kind of recognized as the father of Housing First, came to Charlotte, Mecklenburg, as part of our strategy and did training with nonprofits in the Housing First model and now continues to do monthly phone calls with the frontline social workers who are doing the work, giving them advice and so forth. And basically what Sam Cimbaras said, he was working in a hospital, and he would work with people who were chronically homeless, get them situated in terms of addressing their immediate health issue, send them out of the hospital, and then they would be back. And he would work with them, address their health issue, send them out, they'd be back. And he thought, there's got to be another way. And so what he did was he basically turned things on their head by saying, instead of asking people to achieve all of these goals, whether it's health-related, income-related, while homeless so that they could get housing, let's put this crowd in housing first and then bring all the supportive services that we have in our community to them in the stability of their home. Mm-hmm. And so that's the Housing First model, and we've been using it now for about 9 years.
And one of your core beliefs is that housing is a basic human right,
yes,
not a reward for clinical success.
That's correct.
Is that still considered a progressive idea, or have more and more communities around the country adopted this as it has become apparent that it works?
It does work, and it has become obvious. And now HUD has it as a priority in their funding decisions, so that impacts every community in America. That doesn't mean that the change has not been difficult for some.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is our social workers were all trained in another model in the past, and so there's a transformation for all of us. There's
a learning curve
for all of us.
It's a step away from the carrot and a stick approach, I take it.
Instead of saying, I have a plan for your life if you'll mm-hmm. come and conform to my expectations, we say, what do you need? And we start with that. What do you need? And what people say to us is, I want housing.
So you give them housing, but what if they don't then take advantage of the help that you're going to give them as a result of giving them this housing to get their lives back in order?
What Nobody's required to accept help.
How many don't?
That would be hard to say because it's a dynamic relationship. For instance, in Moore Place, we have half a dozen social workers there. We have a nurse. We have a psychiatrist. We have an activities director. And all of the services are there for mm-hmm. people to access, but we don't have a standard that says, okay, you have to see this social worker so many times this month in order to keep your housing. What people discover is that in the stability of housing, they start to ask themselves questions that they don't ask on the street, because on the street, your number one question is, how do I survive?
Right.
How do I get something to eat? How do I go to sleep? How do I stay warm? How do I stay dry? In the stability of housing, then they start asking questions like, well, what am I going to do with my time? Or why was I drinking so much when I was on the street? Questions they would never ask. I remember one gentleman telling me that he was sleeping under a highway bridge. He was wet. He was cold. He had critters chewing on him at night. The only way he could go to sleep was just drink himself into a stupor.
Mm.
And he said, you guys kept telling me I was killing myself, and I needed to get into a program. And he said, what you were thinking was what's going to happen next year. He said, I was thinking about what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes. He said, now that I'm in this apartment, I'm safe, I'm warm, why am I drinking so much?
Right.
He said, I never would have asked myself that question on the street.
Plus, I would think you wouldn't be able to really think much beyond what you're talking about. If you're in survival mode,
right,
that's all consuming.
You live in the moment.
That's right. So you can't get a job, you can't clean yourself up, you can't plan for anything except where's the next meal coming from?
Right.
And how do I keep the raccoons right. off of my toes.
Right, exactly. And that's why Housing First works,
yeah.
is because you take away those survival thoughts.
And you too, Stacy, are adamant that this approach works, and that you need to be, I think these are your words, that you need to be able to finish it. What will that require?
Need to be able to finish ending chronic homelessness.
Right, exactly. What
yes.
will that require?
I think that it requires a collaborative approach that we currently have. It will require us looking at our affordable housing obstacles that we have in our community. I think those are the big things. I think working together, we know that Housing First works. Using that housing as a platform for stability and not a reward for good behavior is definitely an approach that we've seen success with, and we've seen it across the nation. So I think what we have to be able to recognize is what we're doing is working, mm-hmm. and now we need to keep it going and actually finish the job.
You talk about wrapping services around the people that you house first. That's providing the nurse and the psychiatrist and the whatever else they need. Is that what essentially you're talking about there?
Yes, yes.
They don't feel pressured into using these people. They can say no. They could, because I would think that if you have certain disabilities, mental disabilities perhaps, even an addiction caused disability, that you may not see the need for getting help, or you may deny that you need the help, or you don't want the help because the desire for the drug in an addictive situation is just too strong. So how do you overcome that? Because you really can't help them long term until you work on that aspect of their problem, right?
I think with Housing First, what we've seen with our social workers is kind of flipped it. We actually have the responsibility with the social workers to continually engage the individual. So as opposed to saying, like Dale said, these are the goals, this is what you need to do, we place the onus on the social worker to continually engage that individual, talk about what it is that they need or don't need, and develop that relationship and rapport over time. And what we have seen so far is people will engage. Mm-hmm. Housing First is not housing only. It's housing with services. We're just providing them with a safe place to stay first.
Right. So you give them this place to stay, and if all things work out, they take advantage of the services that you're providing. How long does it take for them to get their lives back together? Are there some people who simply never will get their lives back together because their mental disability is so great that that would be very difficult to overcome?
It's as diverse as the population is. Some people instantly look like different people when they're off the street and in their apartments, and they're behaving differently. Some may not do that. Mm-hmm. And so what we want is we want the opportunity to exist. And, of course, what we know is regardless of the amount of services someone may access, we know that they are safer. We know they are healthier. We know that they don't go to the ER as often. They don't go to jail. They don't go to the hospital as often. They don't ride the ambulance as often. So if they're in that housing, mm-hmm. they're saving our community about $26,000 a year by being in that housing.
Most of us don't see a lot of homeless people, and a lot of people who do see homeless people don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
And they pass them by on the street, but they don't want right. to look at them, and they don't see them. It's embarrassing, or they just don't invade their privacy. And when we do see them, when we do take notice of them, we don't see them as healthy individuals. There's something wrong there. For whatever reason, they're homeless. When you put them in housing, what do you discover about these people? What would surprise us about most of the people that you help?
One of the surprising things that we learned when we did a pilot project with just 14 people when we first decided to try this Housing First model back in 2008, and we had things we wanted to achieve. You know, we wanted to help them have access to health care and so forth. One of the goals that occurred that we didn't set for them was reconnection with family. 8 of the 14 people reconnected with their families, and it was because being in their apartment, their shame went down mm-hmm. and their dignity went up. Nobody ever calls mom and says, hey, I got a new spot under a new bridge. I'd love to come, you know, come see it. But they will say, I'm in this apartment. I would like for you to come
so
see it.
Just the fact that they have housing is a step forward.
Dramatic step forward. Dramatic step forward. And we have people who are absolutely proud of paying their rent because that's something they had not been able to do. And so we have people who are literally are excited about the prospect of getting to pay their rent.
How do they pay their rent?
Well, we help them get their disability benefits if they don't already have them. And then we charge them just 30% of their income. I mentioned earlier the average income at Moore Place is $733. So we charge them 30%, and then we have a partnership through the Charlotte Housing Authority for HUD rent subsidy vouchers called Section 8 vouchers. Those vouchers make up the difference between their 30% and the market rate cost of that apartment, which is how we keep the building operating. Mm.
Most of us don't necessarily see homeless people. You were a pastor of a church.
I was.
That catered to wealthy individuals at one point. And for quite a while, you saw pretty much that population. But somehow, you've transitioned to the mm-hmm. other side of the coin. And you say that the rich and poor, now that you've been in this milieu for a while, the rich and poor have more in common than we think.
Absolutely.
How so?
Well, you strip away all these outer things that we think define us. Mm-hmm. And finally, we all want to be loved. We all want to be safe. We all want to be known. We all want to be respected. We all want to be included. Those are just human experiences. Now, some of us have the means to kind of button up and cover up our hurts. Homeless people don't, and so that makes us look very different on the outside. But on the inside, we're the same.
Dale Mullinex is Executive Director of the Urban Ministry Center. Stacy Lowry is Director of Mecklenburg County Community Support Services. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Leland Little Auctions, presenting their annual summer auction featuring fine art, jewelry, fine wine, and modernism. June 16th through 18th, details lelandlittle.com. And Novant Health Cancer Care, providing customized treatment plans to help give patients the support they need. Information available at novanthealth.org/cancer. A former Stanford student's 6-month jail sentence for raping an unconscious woman has sparked outrage across the country. The growing number of reported sex assaults on campuses and how courts and colleges are responding, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join ours, you can do so by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and we are coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Humanitarian aid has finally reached the battered Syrian city of Deraya, not far from Damascus. It was taken over 4 years ago by Syrian rebel forces.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The district is compact. It covers the northern two-thirds of Mecklenburg County from Charlotte to Lake Norman.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about homelessness and the declining homeless population in Charlotte, thanks to several efforts, among them the Housing First program, which is a joint effort of about 26 different entities, both governmental, non-governmental, nonprofits, etc., and it includes Mecklenburg County. Stacey Lowry is with us from there, where she's director of Mecklenburg County Community Support Services, and Dale Mullinex, executive director of Urban Ministry Center. A lot of people have been commenting on Facebook and Twitter and emails as we've been talking, so let me share some of this with you. Dawn on Facebook writes, "I'm chronically homeless. Not all of us have a disabling condition. I just need a decent, steady job and an affordable place to live. I lost my home of 6 years. I've been living in my car since November 2014. Been working at a law office on a temporary project the last month, but most of the money may be going to car repairs for my 24-year-old car." Is she common or uncommon in that experience?
I would say that's uncommon, but we would welcome her to come to the Urban Ministry Center and let's talk. We can connect her to services that we think will make a difference for her.
To live in your car since 2014 seems to
be hard to imagine, isn't it?
Hard to imagine.
Yep.
Extraordinary. Yep. Brian emails, "Have your guests found an age component to homelessness? I've been at the edge of homelessness for the past year. I find the state woefully inadequate to reconnect people to income, too little unemployment, both in amount and duration, and in access to health care."
I think homelessness affects all age groups. I think when we're talking about the chronically homeless, we tend to see that they are older, mainly because it's taken time for them to either live homeless for X number of years or continually for a year.
I'd agree with that.
What about access to health care? If you're homeless and you haven't got enough money for housing, you don't have enough money to be on the Affordable Care Act either. So your only option is what, the emergency room?
Oftentimes it's the emergency room. But we do have clinics here in town, Charlotte Community Health Clinic, C.W. Williams Clinic, who will see the people that come to the Urban Ministry Center, for instance. And so we encourage people to connect with those clinics.
Charlotte has organizations like yours and others that help the homeless. Mm-hmm. We see homeless on the streets in Charlotte. We see homeless at some major intersections around, or people who purport to be homeless at major intersections around town, asking for money, little signs in their hands, etc. Are they homeless? Are they, in fact, I mean, because there are services. Why don't they just come to you? Why stand in the broiling sun or the freezing cold or the rain and ask for money?
A number of years ago, I asked my staff to go out every evening after we closed our offices and spend, say, from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. throughout the uptown area looking at who are the people panhandling. Mm-hmm. What we discovered in a 2-week period was we did not know 90% of them. Now, we know most of the people who are homeless.
Do they need the money or is it a scam?
Oh, I assume they need the money,
okay.
But that's how they've chosen
to
make their money. They wouldn't do it if they weren't successful, but the point is they're not. Most of them are not homeless.
I'm assuming that you're referring to the survey you took last January in which you discovered that many of the people were not coming to agencies for help.
We do find a good many people, and that's why we increased the outreach team from 3 people to 11 people.
Why aren't they coming?
Oftentimes, it is the it's part of their mental illness. Oh, if I go there, you're going to make me do something. You're going to make me take certain medicines. You're going to require me to believe certain religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of different
How much
reasons.
Of that is true? How many agencies that work with the homeless do require that?
It would be hard to find many, but we have an open-door policy. We don't require anybody to do anything to access our services.
Rebecca emails, I would like to ask the panelists to comment on the impact of Charlotte's lack of a mandatory inclusionary housing ordinance to ensure affordable and mixed-income housing near public transportation and or otherwise close in on the problems of housing loss among minimum wage and very low wage workers.
That's a very good question or comment to have. What we've seen nationally is that some cities that have moved the dial as far as affordable housing do actually have mandatory inclusionary zoning policies, and that's something that Charlotte-Mecklenburg does not have.
We do have incentives.
Yes, we do.
And they haven't worked.
Correct.
For the most part.
For the most part, it looks as though it hasn't been the carrot that we are hoping it would be to incentivize the developers to do that.
Do we understand why?
I don't think that we have that clear understanding right now. What I do know, though, is as part of our housing instability and homelessness report series, we are specifically going to look at affordable housing strategies that have been used across the nation mm-hmm. and provide that information to the Housing Advisory Board of Charlotte-Mecklenburg for consideration.
That was going to be my next question, because you deal with people who deal with homeless people all over the country, and I'm wondering if there are cities who have less of a problem with this because they do have mixed-use affordable housing in new developments and in apartment buildings, et cetera. And where that is working, can that not be used as an example to our own city of where it works and how it works?
Yes, it can be used as an example, and I think that's one of the strategies that we'll look at when we do the report.
But do you have to convince the city or the county, or do you have to convince the developers who are out to make money, and that's why they're in business, to make money?
I think it would be convincing all three, and also the state of North Carolina. We'd have to go to the legislation to be able to change things.
In other words, we have to have the legislature's permission to do these things.
Correct.
Okay. How likely is that, given their love for Charlotte-Mecklenburg?
I think that's a very good question.
Kelly emails, I am puzzled over the best way to assist what appears to be the chronically homeless individuals who wait at busy intersections. We just talked about this. Busy intersections for assistance from those of us waiting at the traffic light. My Christian foundation obliges me to provide a handout. Can your panelists let me know if this is the best thing to do for these individuals? Would it be better to know about the services that are available and hand them a piece of paper with the information on that?
We actually have created a card that we've circulated throughout the community, and it basically says what to do if you're asked for money by a panhandler. Mm-hmm. And the bottom of the card is perforated, so you can tear it off and hand it to the person, and it has a list of our services and a map to our place. Every one of us have had the experience of giving money and then thinking, I'm not sure that was a good idea. And every one of us have had the experience of not giving the money and think, I'm not sure if that was such a good idea.
If you're standing at the intersection of Tivola Road, I know this happens because I've seen it happen 1,000 times, Tivola Road and the exit to I-77, or Woodlawn.
Yep.
How easy is it for those people to get to you? I mean, they're out there, one presumes, with no transportation.
Well, again, we may very well be talking about people who are not homeless, and they may very well have their own transportation. And so it's you can't assume mm-hmm. that they're homeless and have no transportation to us. Somehow they got to those parts of town. They've shown some indication of an ability.
Of mobility.
Yeah, of mobility.
If you are approached by somebody on the street because they say they're hungry and they just need a couple of bucks, Should you give them the money? Should you send them off to you? Should you take them to a restaurant and buy them lunch?
I think everybody has to decide for themselves. What we recommend is that you send them to an organization like ours. And it's not because we don't want you to be helpful or charitable toward a person in need. It's just that we have so much experience that indicates that the person asking you for that money very likely may not need the money for food. And so
don't speak in code.
Yeah, so they
need it for a drink.
They may,
need it.
Your $2 may turn into Wild Irish Rose,
right?
And that's just a reality that we have confronted. So we think it's much more productive to say, go to one of these agencies that will help you, and then the person can decide, mm-hmm. and you know you've done something positive.
Christopher on Twitter, as an intern in adult behavioral health, I see a lot of chronically homeless people with severe mental health issues, and often there are what's known as repeat offenders. Do you understand what he's saying there? I don't, so I'm just asking.
I'm not sure what the repeat offense is.
But if you have a severe mental health issue, mm-hmm. how are you equipped to handle those problems?
Absolutely. You know, like for instance, on our—
Be in perpetuity then?
It depends. If we start treating their illness as opposed to— I mean, trying to treat someone's mental illness on the street, mm-hmm. we know is not helpful. But if we could get them into the stability of housing, surround them with supportive services, then— Who knows what might happen?
We've talked about what it costs not to help these people because then they use public services like the emergency room, et cetera. And it costs, I think you said, $39,000 a year per person mm-hmm. on average. What does it cost to take care of these people? What does it cost and who pays the cost of helping these people in the way you're talking about, housing first?
Well, our studies done with the university says it's right just under $14,000 per person per year.
So it's half the price.
But less than half, yeah.
And the taxpayer picks up, I would think, and people who use medical services pick up the cost of not helping these people. Who picks up the cost of helping them?
Well, it's a shared cost. So, for instance, we've talked about the different components. There are basically three components that help someone be successful in housing. One, they got to have the unit, obviously, the apartment. Mm-hmm. They have to have the wraparound services, which the county has been providing, and they have to have that rent subsidy so they can stay in their apartment, and that's where the Housing Authority has been our partner. So if we put those three resources together, we see the successes that we've been having.
You mentioned More Place, and we did a whole program on this when More Place was about to or had just opened, I've forgotten which. And this is the housing complex that you have built mm-hmm. Specifically right. with this in mind.
Right.
How many people does that house?
Right now it houses 85, but next Wednesday we will have a celebration where we will open up an additional 35 units that we've just built.
So that's about 100.
120.
But the chronically homeless population at last report was 500 and something, right?
Well, it's down to 300.
So yep. That will service a third of those people. So where do the other two-thirds go?
Well, those apartments, we're going to fill those 35 this uh-huh. summer, so that's a portion. Mm-hmm. We are getting ready to build another More Place-like facility with 120 units, but we also work with private landlords throughout the community. And so the number we haven't announced so far on the show is that since we started the Housing First Initiative, we've housed 323 people as of the end of May. We started with that original 516. As I said, the registry is dynamic, so we've found some more people. Mm-hmm. But we've housed 323 people in the last 15 months.
Let's talk about their lives after you intervene and help and get them housing, and perhaps they take advantage of the services that you provide to help them get their lives back on track.
Right.
How many of them find stability in their life?
Well, if they're in housing, they're stable. What we look for now is meaning. How do we find meaning? We are not believers that being middle class is salvation. It's just not going to happen for some of them. And so what we look for is how do we help this person find meaning in the life they are living? So it might be reconnecting with their families. It might be learning some new skills. It might be enhancing their reading. It might be volunteering in the community. We have a vast array of examples of people totally changing their life around. One example would be a resident at More Place who loves public policy is the vice president of his neighborhood association. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
We have people who volunteer at the food bank. There are people who participate in labyrinth walks. These are meditative guided meditations. I mean, there are just a variety of ways that their lives have changed.
As of February, you report that Housing First Charlotte-Mecklenburg has housed, you gave a figure out a second ago, but that's 93% of them are in apartments today. Mm-hmm. So that's successful because
they've
stayed?
Rate.
Because they've stayed.
Yeah, that's what that means.
Meaning that they've stabilized their lives.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you also point out that of the 254 people, I think five have been homeless a total of 130 years. That's 26 years each on average. Yep. That, to me, is unbelievable.
It was unbelievable to me. Now, depending on what neighborhood you live in, some of the listeners know these people because they would see them in Plaza Midwood or other places where they were regulars mm-hmm. on the street. What that number means to me more than anything else is nobody is a lost cause. These are people that most of us would have thought their lives will never change.
Right.
But we have the evidence that they can. So nobody's a lost cause. We don't give up on anybody.
And Stacey, you claim to an 85 to 90% success rate using a Housing First approach, as opposed to less than 60% under the housing readiness model, which works in reverse. You get yourself ready, then we'll find you housing. Has that helped you in your cause, both in convincing county officials and convincing donors to the program, et cetera, that raising money is important and actually helps the situation? You're not throwing it away.
I think that the research definitely helps us in our cause when we're looking at whether it's public officials or private donors giving money for that. What we're finding is nationally and internationally, housing stability rates when you use Housing First is between 80 and 90%. Mm-hmm. And what we range here is between 88% to 91%. So we're doing a really good job.
Last year, Fayetteville and Winston-Salem ended homelessness for military veterans. I think Raleigh's on track to do the same thing. Where does Charlotte lie? Or lay in that area?
I believe that the last number that I had heard regarding Housing Our Heroes was that we had approximately 20 to 25 veterans still on our registry. Just like the Chronically Homeless Registry, it is dynamic. Mm-hmm. We had housed over 300 veterans in the last year.
And how do people help?
They can give us money. They can volunteer. For instance, all these people were moving in. We have a thing called Welcome Home Kits mm-hmm. where you can help put together a box of basic supplies that everybody needs to move into their first apartment.
What's your web address?
It's urbanministrycenter.org or it's housingfirstcharmec.org.
And you get the last word. Dale Molinex with Urban Ministry Center, Stacey Lowry with Mecklenburg County.
Charlotte Tom.